From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. 8 is the number of remaining NFL playoff teams ahead on Only a Game. We'll cut that number in half before the games even begin. Also, while barbs flew between the Pats and the Jets, a barber shared laughs, styling tips, and career advice with current and former NFL players.
If he cut your hair on a Friday at 2 o'clock and you had a great game, well, you're probably going to have to cut his hair on a Friday at 2 o'clock until something bad happens. And then, you know, you got to try something else.
Also ahead, Major League umpire Jim Joyce struggles to make sense of the blown perfect game and will meet polo players who prefer pedals to ponies. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The NFL's divisional playoffs kick off today, but divisive playoffs might be more like it, what with the Pats and Jets trading barbs all week. Here to discuss the plethora of pregame provocations and put-downs, and maybe even talk a little bit of football as well, is the ever-civil Greg Doyle of CBSSports.com. Greg, welcome back to the program.
You just said a whole lot of P-words on NPR, Bill. I hope that's okay.
I hope so, too. This weekend's divisional series begins with Pittsburgh hosting Baltimore this afternoon. These two teams are extremely stingy when it comes to giving up points. So does the outcome depend upon which team plays better on the offensive end?
I think it's going to come down to which team has a better field goal kicker. These two teams have played twice. They split the two games, and if you add up the total scores, it was 27-27. So it doesn't get a whole lot closer than that, which means they were averaging about 14 a game each game. So someone's going to win with a kick, whether it's an extra point or a field goal. And kicking at Heinz Field with the wind swirling, it's a brutal place to kick. It's by far the worst kicking environment in the NFL. So this game will come down to a kick, whether it's a made kick or a missed kick, don't know.
Since you mentioned the evenness of these two teams, maybe this is the game that ends in a tie and we get to invoke this new set of rules that the NFL has put in.
It's unbelievable. If you return the opening kickoff for a touchdown or you drive down for a touchdown, the game's over. But if you return the opening kickoff and then go kick a field goal, the other team gets the ball too. It's very confusing, not real smart. The only thing shocking about the NFL overtime, really, is that Bud Selig didn't come up with it. That's how dumb it is. Poor Bud. He deserves better than that.
I'm sure
he doesn't.
Green Bay is in Atlanta for a game tonight. The Packers, of course, have a long and proud playoff history, and the Falcons not so much. What has to happen for Atlanta, the NFC's number one seed, to change that during this postseason?
Well, they've already played once and won the game, the Falcons did, but it was very close. It came down to a last-second field goal. The Falcons won at home. So these teams are very close, and that was before Green Bay discovered a rookie running back named James Starks, who last week ran for over 100 yards against the Eagles. He didn't even play in the first game. In the first game, Aaron Rodgers of the Packers threw for 350 yards. If he can do anything close to that, and Starks can do anything close to what he did to the Eagles, then Green Bay wins this game on the road. So, in fact, that's what I'm going to predict is going to happen.
Seattle is at Chicago tomorrow afternoon, and this would seem to be a mismatch. Chicago was 11-5 and won the NFC North. Seattle was 7-9 and slipped into the postseason amid much snickering, at least from this program. But they beat the Super Bowl champs last week, and perhaps they're gathering some momentum. What do you think?
Yeah, well, Chicago has two big problems. Their quarterback is Jay Cutler, and their coach is Lovie Smith. And I'm not sure either of those two guys is capable of performing at a high level with a lot of pressure on. They're both, what I'm trying to say is, they're both choke artists. Furthermore, these teams have played this year, and Seattle actually won the game, and it was in Chicago. Now, granted, there are some mitigating circumstances. There always are. In that game, Jay Cutler, the Bears quarterback, was playing his first game after having a concussion 2 weeks earlier, so he was probably not as steady as he's going to be. That said, he's still Jay Cutler. He still chokes. I like the Seahawks to win that game.
I don't really know, of course, who will win that game, but I am absolutely certain that win or lose, Seattle head coach Pete Carroll will be totally pumped, stoked, psyched, jazzed, electrified, and energized afterwards. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. And he'll also probably bring a copy of his book and try and hawk it. It was called Win Forever or something like that at Southern Cal, which when he should have called it Cheat Forever because that's what they did. But anyway, the book could be sold, I'm guessing.
Well, it's fair to say they did both. I mean, they won and they cheated.
Yeah, if you're going to cheat, at least win out of it. There are some schools that cheat and don't know how to win. He got banged for his buck, and there were a lot of bucks involved.
The ever-so-tactful Jets and always-humble Patriots engaged in a war of words this week. Who won the rhetorical rivalry, and perhaps more importantly, which team is going to win the actual game once it mercifully arrives?
Same answer for both. The Patriots won the war of words because they didn't lower themselves to meet the Jets in the sewer. I mean, the Jets calling the Patriots names, throwing out F-bombs, and just really embarrassing themselves. Rex Ryan is a total clown, a buffoon. He's got that idiot Antonio Cromartie, his cornerback, is saying negative stuff about the Patriots when Cromartie's got 14 kids with 18 different women. I'm not even sure how that's possible. That's what he did. The Patriots just wouldn't talk about it. They're not talking about it. And why should they? They won the last time they played 45-3, and I hope it's 52-3 this time. I'm really upset with the Jets.
Well, I guess you have picked a winner in that one with your heart. Does your head tell you the same thing?
Yeah, absolutely. The Patriots did win the last meeting not too long ago, 45-3, in the same building, the same stadium it's going to be played at. The Jets are a good team. They are good, but the Patriots have taken off in the last 2 months. Tom Brady is at a whole another level, and I don't see this game being – I mean, I see it being close. It's not going to be 45-3, but this could be the most lopsided game of the four playoff games this weekend.
Greg, let's move into the future to Super Bowl XLV. Which two teams are playing in that?
That'll be a classic game between two teams that have been in the Super Bowl a whole lot. The Patriots recently and the Green Bay Packers a long time ago. I can see those two teams meeting up. And I like the Patriots to win their 19th Super Bowl in the last 12 years.
Greg Doyle is a national columnist for CBSSports.com, and he joins me from time to time here on Only a Game as well to talk football. Greg, thanks very much.
Sure, thanks. And all of my numbers that I mentioned, they all add up, I promise.
Different football teams have different ways of preparing for game day. This week, the New York Jets' preparation for tomorrow's game against the New England Patriots included cornerback Antonio Cromartie telling reporters he hated Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. He said he thought Brady was an expletive. On Thursday, Brady shrugged off the insult, saying he'd been called worse. During a press conference that day, Jets head coach Rex Ryan maintained that his cornerback's comments were no big deal.
Trust me, they're saying a lot worse about me and others here. Maybe it just wasn't printed.
If Coach Ryan is right, nothing was printed because no Pats player anywhere near a reporter made a controversial remark. Patriots head coach Bill Belichick wills it so, a circumstance that encouraged Coach Ryan to zing his New England counterpart.
We're a transparent organization. We let our guys speak, and we don't try to tell them what to say or what not to say. You know, a guy makes a comment, big deal.
If we hear it, it's going one end, not the other.
That's New England wide receiver Darnell Jenkins. On Wednesday, he was preparing for tomorrow's game by getting his hair cut.
Only thing we're listening to this week is the coaches talk, the coaches coach, and us going out there and executing the game plan. That's the only thing we're worrying about this week.
Because he's still rehabilitating his knee after surgery a couple of months ago, Jenkins won't be available for tomorrow's game. But like many of his teammates who will be on the field, this week he stuck to his pregame routine, which always includes a visit to Terrence Manning, proprietor of Soho Hair Design in North Attleboro, Massachusetts, and barber to the Patriots. Why? The slightly shaggy pre-trimmed Darnell Jenkins told me.
When that helmet come off, when you make a big play.
Ah, when the television camera zooms in close.
And when you walk to the sideline after scoring the touchdown, making a big tackle, you take your helmet off and you look to the right and it's right there.
And that being the camera.
That being the camera. And if you're looking like this, you kind of don't want to say nothing more than hi, Mom.
Darnell Jenkins learned about Terrence Manning from teammates who discovered they could trust the barber's judgment and his touch. Former Pats tight end Christian Fourier, who'd also dropped by for a midweek haircut, explained how so many of the Pats had come to be Manning's regulars.
We're creatures of habit.
and we're superstitious. So if he cut your hair on a Friday at 2 o'clock and you had a great game, well, you're probably going to have to cut his hair on a Friday at 2 o'clock until something bad happens. And then, you know, you've got to try something else.
For the Pats, winners of three Super Bowls since 2002, not all that much bad has happened, and that in part explains why Darnell Jenkins was in the chair on Wednesday.
This is the most important part of this hair-cutting part, you know, is doing up the beard and the mustache, you know, because if he moves just too much, he could lose his mustache.
Don't laugh.
Though Terrence Manning styles himself stylist of the stars, or at least the stars of the Patriots, they receive no special treatment if they just wander in.
I set my schedule up for like 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon. It's just dedicated to the Patriots. You know, if they come in other than that, they might have to set an appointment, because then I have all my other clients that come in on those other days.
Okay, so it's not a Patriot shows up and you say to everybody else, okay, everybody out of here, Patriot time.
No, and the best thing about those guys, they have respect for, you know, my job. So if they see that I have somebody sitting in the chair, they'll wait.
But are Patriots players good tippers?
They're all great tippers. Why do I always get asked that question? But no, they are. A lot of the guys that come and see me, they're younger guys, just ran into all of this. And some of them, like, really have these, their wives that really like penny pinchers. And they're just like, no, that's too much money. But, you know, I try to keep it fair for them and for my regular clients.
Even as a guy who generally pays about the minimum for a haircut, I found that Terrence's rates did sound fair. So after the Patriot and the expatriate had left the building, at which point I was officially off the clock, I sat down in the barber's chair and asked Terrence to see what he could accomplish.
My question is, when you're finished, am I going to be able to throw a ball 80 yards and, you know, run 100 yards much faster than I ever did before?
If you can do that after you get this haircut, I suggest you keep coming back to me to get your haircut.
I do not run faster or throw harder than I did before Terrence Manning cut my hair, but I might go back anyway. Of course, I might not be able to do that during the week before February 6th. That's because if the Patriots make it to the Super Bowl again, Terrence Manning, shears and clippers in hand, will be joining them in Arlington, Texas.
Get a haircut and get a real job. Get a haircut and get a real job. Clean your act up and don't be a slob. Get it together like your big brother Bob. Why don't you get a haircut and get a real job?
If you'd like more information about Only a Game's music selections, please check our weekly music blog by visiting us at onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Howdy-do, homeless mama here. That's right, it's me. I'm hanging out here in the bushes. I've decided to be homeless because obviously that is the best way for a person to become famous in this country nowadays. So, here's what I'm on.
The heartwarming story about Ted Williams, the homeless man whose booming baritone has brought him to the attention of the Cleveland Cavaliers, among other potential employers, has not warmed everybody's heart. Actress Vicki Lawrence, who created a TV character named Mama, has made a video in which Mama has embraced homelessness as the route to fame and fortune as an endorser of products. In the video, she tells potential job seekers not to bother about school, training, or internships, since being homeless is apparently working for Ted Williams. Advocates for the homeless are not thrilled with Ms. Lawrence's video. How can that be? I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. ESPN's Amy K. Nelson discusses her recent visit with Major League umpire Jim Joyce, who blew the call that would have made Armando Galarraga the 21st pitcher to throw a perfect game. But first, here to talk about Duke's upset this week at the hands of Florida State and other matters pertaining to men's college hoops is ESPN's Pat Forty. Hi, Pat.
Hey, Bill, how are you?
Very well, thank you. On Wednesday night, unranked Florida State handed Duke its first loss of the season. What precipitated that unlikely outcome, and will the Blue Devils bounce back from the loss?
Well, it has been known to happen before. This is actually the third time that Florida State has beaten Duke when Duke was number one in Tallahassee. So they've got a thing for that. And, you know, the other thing that really kind of made Duke vulnerable is the toe injury to Kyrie Irving, their freshman point guard, who probably, just even as a freshman, was among the five best players in America. And he's been out for quite some time. And so Duke, without him, is a much less vaunted team than they are with him.
Well, what about for the rest of the season? Does Duke look like they will continue to be toward the top?
Duke's going to continue to win a bunch of games because the ACC really is not very good this year. We're still trying to figure out who's the second best team in that league, whether it's North Carolina, who's been a disappointment, Virginia Tech, who's been a disappointment, or some other fairly middling opposition. So, you know, even without Kyrie Irving, Duke is probably going to be the best team in the ACC. The question is, without Kyrie Irving, can they win a national title? That remains to be seen, but they're going to be in the mix. Even without him, they're a top 10, probably top 5 team.
Ohio State, Kansas, and Syracuse are currently ranked 2, 3, and 4, respectively. Will one of those currently undefeated teams jump ahead of Duke once the Week 11 rankings are determined?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, probably Ohio State, if Ohio State wins again. I mean, they've been incredibly impressive, and their freshman center, Jared Sullinger, you know, may be the best guy in America at this point. He's been a double-double machine, you know, incredibly skilled and tenacious in the paint. I would say they have the best chance to be the next number one. You know, the other teams undefeated as well, Kansas and Syracuse, both are having great seasons so far. And Duke was kind of head and shoulders above the rest of them, but you put a loss on them, and the other three can almost throw a blanket over them.
Ohio State President E. Gordon Gee was highly critical of the BCS this season, Pat. Please don't tell me he's not in favor of the way March Madness plays out.
You know, I would guess if President Gee had his way, you would take 10 blue blood schools and have them play each other and tell everybody else, no, I'm sorry, you go play the Little Sisters of the Poor. You are not good enough. You go in your own little sandbox, and we'll decide the real title over here. I do hope President Gee did see the result of the Rose Bowl, in which one of those teams that he poo-pooed, Texas Christian, beat the Big Ten champion, Wisconsin. Let's hope he saw that game.
The 2011 tournament field will expand from 65 to 68. What do you see as the pros and cons of the new arrangement?
I see nothing but cons, to be honest. You know, I see what it is basically is a chance to make some more coaches happy in the big conferences by getting the eighth best team in, you know, some power league into the tournament. It may help the third or fourth best team in the Missouri Valley as well, but I think the main reason there is to, you know, further grease the skids for the power elite conferences. What it does, it creates more games on that Tuesday, which, you know, from a television standpoint, I'm sure will be a plus, because when it was, say, Rider against Alabama State, it was not a big TV draw. But if you're going to put Virginia Tech in there against, say, California or something, you're going to get more eyeballs to that than you would in somebody else. So you put four games on that day, you get some bigger names, and there's going to be a little bit bigger TV draw, but it's not going to add to the quality of the tournament one little bit.
Currently residing in the number 6 spot are the Aztecs of San Diego State. What's in the water there in the Mountain West Conference?
Yeah, how about that? Isn't that a nice little twist? And that's one of the great things about basketball is you get to see a little bit more of the Novo Riche, you know, kind of popping up every once in a while. And San Diego State, with Steve Fisher, who you may recall won a national title 21 years ago, and who took the Fab Five to the Final Four in consecutive seasons in the early 90s, most people thought that all he did was ride the coattails of some great talent, but you know what? He was actually a pretty good coach, and I think he's proving it now at San Diego State. He's got a good bunch of players there. They made the tournament last year, and back again this year with a team that looks very, very good. And San Diego State has no basketball heritage at all, so kind of fun to see them in the mix.
Butler made it to the championship game last April to the delight of mid-major followers everywhere, but they appear to have fallen off the map. What happened to the Bulldogs?
Well, probably the best player in school history, Gordon Hayward, went pro after his sophomore year. He was a top 10 NBA pick, and I think they found out that life after Gordon is not quite that easy. And he was a guy that did everything for them. He would He was their best rebounder. He was their best scorer. He could play defense on anybody from a small forward to a center. He could bring the ball up the court against the press. And, you know, when you're Butler, as good as that program has been and as well-coached as they are and as good a job as they've done recruiting, if you take a special, once-in-a-lifetime kind of player out of the mix, you're going to have some backslide there.
Pat, there are a number of games this weekend that will feature top 25 teams. Which ones will you pay particular attention to?
I'm watching my daughter at a swim meet this weekend. I don't know who's playing who.
Well, please wish her our best. This may be more important than any basketball team.
I will. I mean, I will find a way to watch college basketball. I'm just not sure who I should be watching this weekend. I'll pick it back up next week.
Pat Forte's 40-yard dash column appears on the ESPN website. He joins me from time to time to talk men's hoops as well. Thank you, Pat.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
If you'd like to read my reviews of the books we feature on Only a Game, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. On June 2nd in Detroit, with two outs in the ninth inning, Cleveland Indians shortstop Jason Donald grounded to the right side of the infield. Umpire Jim Joyce called him safe at first base, and Donald became the only base runner Detroit pitcher Armando Galarraga had allowed that night. That might have been the end of the story, except that Jim Joyce missed the call. In the umpire's room after the game, he watched the film and saw that he should have called Jason Donald out. Jim Joyce's mistake had cost Armando Galarraga a perfect game. ESPN's Amy K. Nelson recently visited Jim Joyce at his home in Oregon for the network's Outside the Line series, and she joins me now on the phone. Amy, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
When you asked Jim Joyce if you could visit with him, was he receptive, or did you get the feeling that he just wished everybody would allow the story of his mistake to die?
Either read the piece online or maybe saw it, you can get a pretty good sense that Joyce is a pretty nice person, pretty affable, and definitely very open. And so when I contacted him, he said, this is what it's been like. I mean, one of the very first things he said to me in our first conversation over the telephone was that I still think about this every day. And that struck me. And then I gently sort of broached with him, well, what do you think about trying to do a story together, and he was open to it really from the get-go.
After he called Jason Donald safe, how quickly did Joyce begin to get indications that he was wrong?
His first instinct was that he got it right. Mm-hmm. He said, I was positive I got it right. The players didn't immediately approach him with, I think, the verb that they later did, including Jim Leland. Until they went and saw the replay, which they are able to do, basically the umpires are the only ones who aren't able to do that, once they went into the tunnel and saw the replay, they started coming out and started yelling at him from across the field. And he told me that's when something first started creeping into his mind, just based on his experience, that, hey, if all these players are coming out and they're angry and they're yelling at me and there's a lot of them, then, I probably got the call wrong. But in his mind, he told me, he kept saying, I think I got it right.
And, of course, one of his colleagues, a fellow umpire, did say to him, pal, I think you missed it.
That's when he turned to the crew chief, Daryl Cousins, in the umpire's room, and he just said, did I miss it? And Cousins gave him his honest opinion. He said, Jimmy, I think you missed it. He was very upset when Cousins told him that, but he still wanted to see for himself, and that's when he went and saw the replay for the first and only time, he told me, which astounds me, considering how much that play has been shown over the past 7 months, especially, obviously, in the days following the mistake and the blown call. But he said, every time it even, I had a sense that it was coming on TV, I just turned my head or turned the channel off. He's like, I don't need to see it. I've seen it in my mind a million times. I don't need to see it again.
The night after the missed call, Armando Galarraga presented the Tigers' lineup card to Jim Joyce at home plate. It was a gesture of forgiveness and acceptance, and from Joyce's standpoint, how much did it help?
It helped quite a bit. Joyce told me that he had no idea. No one clued him in that that was going to happen. So he was already emotional. He jokes a lot. He says, you know, I'm Irish, I'm emotional. It's just the way we are. And he saw Galarraga, you know, sort of jump out of the dugout with the lineup card in his hand. He was stunned. The gesture clearly meant everything to him. And he even said in our interview, he said, you know, I probably shouldn't be admitting this considering I'm a professional umpire, but I couldn't even see the lineup card because my eyes were welled with tears. And he's like, I could have been pitching. You know, I didn't even know who was playing or in the lineup that day.
Numbers of fans were not as gracious as Armando Galarraga, the pitcher who lost his perfect game, was. Which emails or other messages most distressed Jim Joyce?
Well, for sure they were the emails and the messages that his grown children received that night. Many of them were laced with death threats. And once Joyce heard about that from his wife, Kay, he was obviously very concerned and very upset. Most people wrote into the commissioner's office, and obviously most people wrote in with positive notes. But some individual brilliantly decided to write a death threat and put his return address on the envelope. For good reason, officials at Major League Baseball thought no one would ever put a return address on a death threat, and so they sent the letter off to Joyce with a package of other letters. And Joyce just happened to be in Houston, Texas when he gets this package, and it says, you know, oh, by the way, if you're ever in Texas, you will be shot. Joyce is sitting in Houston, Texas, so he wound up calling MLB security, and, you know, they got him extra security, and he had extra security with him for the rest of the season, and obviously that was a bit unnerving.
There were also a lot of messages of support, of course, from fans, from officials in other sports, even some impromptu notes from baggage handlers at the airport in Detroit.
How rare is it in our day and age that we even handwrite notes? You know, everything's electronic. And that they take a pen and they write the two notes of encouragement on his luggage tags, in Detroit, no less. One of them said, "We are all human. Good luck." It was signed DTW Baggage. And that's basically what Armando Galarraga had told Joyce that night when they met in the umpire's room. Joyce didn't even notice them until he got to his hotel, looks down and says, oh, my gosh, wow. And carefully takes them off his luggage and puts them in his briefcase and carries them with him in his briefcase for the rest of the season.
Jim Joyce told you at one point that making the mistake almost felt worse than his father's death, which had happened a year before he missed the call. Did that sentiment surprise you?
Very much so. In fact, during our interview, I went back to him and said, is that really true? And he affirmed that completely. And I think part of the reason why is because his whole life has been about baseball. He went to Bowling Green on a scholarship. He was a pitcher, never played professionally, then soon became an umpire after that. And he took his job extremely seriously and very professionally. And there's a reason why all the players voted him the best umpire in Major League Baseball. And he takes great pride in that. And so when your world for so many years, for almost 30 years, has been umpiring and your reputation is the best, it was devastating to him.
I'm talking with ESPN's Amy K. Nelson about umpire Jim Joyce, whose blown call ruined a perfect game. And you're listening to Only a Game. Jim Joyce's wife, Kay, said to you, I want us to remember. Why?
I can understand why she wanted them to remember all of the positive notes, because there were hundreds of them. They were really remarkable, sitting in their kitchen, going through these scrapbooks with them that Kay had made. Was very powerful. But she was also talking about remembering the negative as well. Mm-hmm. And that surprised me. And she said, I think you have to remember the negative along with the positive to understand why people took the lessons they did out of this whole experience. That was impressive to me and definitely a little surprising. But I think it speaks to the character of both of them. They're both very solid people, and they also have a very good sense of humor. And they try not to take themselves too seriously. And I think that helps with the way they've approached this entire situation.
You write at one point of Jim Joyce that, quote, he's still trying to make sense of it all. How's he doing in that regard?
He says that he, every day, almost every day, he still thinks about it, that it is by far the worst mistake he's ever made in his life, and he calls it the worst mistake and umpiring mistake in Major League history. I mean, he attaches those labels to himself without anyone having to do that for him. And when you do that, I think it's very difficult to work yourself out of that hole and those feelings. But at the same time, he's a positive person and he's a good person, I think. I think those things help him try and move on. And he did tell me, though, in looking ahead to next season when spring training starts and the umpires start to go and umpire spring training games, he's going to be a little nervous. Mm. He's not sure exactly what to expect. His wife told me that when the World Series ended, when baseball was finally over, that's when he really started to become more like his old self. So what will happen when baseball resumes? We don't know. I don't think he knows. But I think this experience and talking about it, and certainly he told me he never sought therapy, professional help, but that speaking with Kay, his wife of 28 years, has done him a world of good in trying to move beyond the mistake.
Amy K. Nelson is a reporter for ESPN.com. You can find a link to her story about umpire Jim Joyce at our website, onlyagame.org. Amy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I know everybody make a mistake sometimes.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School offers online and on-campus courses to students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
Dog bites man? Not a story. Man bites dog? Yeah, that's a story. But what about fox shoots man? In Belarus this week, a hunter who has managed to remain anonymous wounded a fox. When the hunter tried to finish off his prey with the butt of his rifle, a curious strategy if there ever was one, the animal sprang into action and pulled the trigger of the gun, shooting the hunter in the leg. "Now we're even," said the fox. The hunter retreated to a nearby hospital for treatment, and the fox escaped into the woods. All true, except the part about what the fox said. I wasn't there, so I don't know what he actually said. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a gentleman's game that's rough around the edges, bike polo. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the weekly news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Tomorrow, the New York Jets will take on the New England Patriots in what is apparently the most important game in the history of history, at least according to East Coast media. Is it a sign that you've really said too much when Reggie Jackson, never slow to trash talk during his baseball days, thinks that you should shut up?
Yeah, this was really quite something. You know, there's been words going back and forth. Antonio Cromartie called Tom Brady a name that you don't hear on the fashion runways of Paris. And Reggie Jackson has decided that he should, quote, shut up and play football, and recommends that Cromartie to come up to Foxborough and, quote, look at the hardware, dude. Now, this is, remember, coming from a guy who, you know, hit the ground spouting off about 60-odd years ago, and hasn't stopped since, hardware be damned. So, yeah, I think this is an indication that you may have gone too far.
All right, what about the three other games that will occur this weekend? Ravens, Steelers, Packers, Falcons, Seahawks, Bears. Any of these likely to delight?
Well, the Ravens and the Steelers will delight various emergency rooms in and around the Pittsburgh metropolitan area. For me, I think the matchup between Aaron Rodgers and Matt Ryan in the Green Bay Atlanta game is the most intriguing of the others.
The Cleveland Browns hired a new coach for the fifth time since 1999. Will Pat Shurmur have any better luck than Chris Palmer, Butch Davis, Romeo Crennel, and Eric Mangini did?
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, this is Mike Holmgren getting Mike Holmgren's guy. Mike Holmgren is the football guru with the Browns. So at least there won't be a conflict between the coach and general manager right from the top. The first thing Pat Shurmur has to do out there is decide and settle on a quarterback and hand him the keys, basically.
The Denver Broncos have finally found a head coach, their first three choices having declined to be interviewed for the position. Does John Fox start with a handicap if his players know that he was the fourth choice for the job?
It depends. I mean, he was a good coach at Carolina for a long while before things went completely bad there. Maybe NFL coaches just don't coach well at altitude.
To the surprise of nobody, Charlie, Auburn quarterback and Heisman Trophy winner Cam Newton has declared for the 2011 NFL Draft. The Carolina Panthers have the first pick, so do they take the versatile player with a history of somewhat checkered operations?
Well, first of all, none of the checkered operations outside of the lifting of the laptop early on, none of those checkered operations have anything to do with his ability to play professional football. I think the pressure to take him is going to be overwhelming.
I want to know if his dad is shopping him to other teams.
Well, he did say the decision was difficult for me and my family. And as we know, Cam's family is used to difficult decisions when it comes to his football career.
In the BCS championship game on Monday night, Auburn beat Oregon 22-19. Tight game, lots of publicity surrounding Cam Newton, but the ratings for that game were down 11% from last year. Why weren't more people paying attention?
Because last year was Alabama and Texas, which are two programs that even a non-college football fan has heard of. Auburn and Oregon, while both terrific teams and who presented a terrific game, just don't have that kind of profile. Which is, by the way, a cautionary tale for everybody who's very enthusiastically pushing a playoff for college football. You're going to wind up sooner or later with a national championship game like this anyway.
Charlie, I would like to offer a public service announcement for our listeners in and around Wayne, Michigan. If you're in the market for some Michigan football gear, we got a line this week on where 432 items will be selling for cheap.
Rich Rodriguez doesn't want to remember his time at Michigan very well, so he donated all of them to the Salvation Army. They're going to sell everything from $6 to, I guess they're going to auction a couple of them, but the head of the Salvation Army said they're not going to mark things up higher than 25%.
No streak lasts forever, and the Miami Heat finally lost a road game this week, having won 13 consecutive times away from home. But are you a little bit surprised by which team beat the Heat?
It was the Clippers who have actually started to get their feet under them a little bit. Of course, Miami went on to get roasted by Denver. LeBron James is not healthy at this point. He's got a bad ankle. I think this was, given what the Heat managed to do against the crosstown team in Los Angeles, this was something of a surprise.
Good news from the Commissioner of Baseball's office this week. Unlike the NFL and the NBA, Bud Selig says Major League Baseball and its union are on, quote, a constructive path toward a new collective bargaining agreement for 2012. So how long before baseball announces a lockout?
Let's just say it's a long path, and there are parts of it that are likely to be under construction rather than constructive.
I don't know why Trevor Hoffman decided to announce his retirement mid-January, but he did, and we should mention it since he is baseball's all-time save leader. Given 667 save opportunities, he recorded 601 saves. He said this week, "I was able to be a kid until I was 43. I think you and I have him beat in terms of length of time being a kid, don't you?
Yeah, but give him credit for saying that. I mean, that's a nice way to go out.
Absolutely.
And I'm waiting for the day where he's inducted into the Hall of Fame and they play Hell's Bells, which is what his music was when he came out of the bullpen. I think that would be very cool, and I think a lot of people in Cooperstown would fall out of their lawn chairs.
Charlie, the Shoot Coach Lane's Bobblehead Day will go on today in Tennessee, despite the fact that the charity previously associated with the event no longer wishes to receive the proceeds. Do you agree with organizer Brent Williams' assertion that this day is necessary closure for fans still angry 365 days after Lane Kiffin's departure, or do you agree with those who say that this event is simply in poor taste?
If we had gun laws in this country that were worth a damn, anybody who's still mad at Lane Kiffin a year later would be kept away from firearms. It would be on the application. No, this is a terrible week to do this. People should not show up. The guy who's putting it on should be ashamed of himself, and this thing shouldn't happen.
And finally, Charlie, the event I'm about to ask you to comment on occurred in a hockey rink, which connects
sports!
It, albeit vaguely, to sports, or so I am bound to maintain. Aren't you glad that you did not buy a ticket to see, quote, the fantasy heroes and performing animals at the circus in Belarus this week?
You got to give the marketing people credit. They promised black bears, crocodiles, monkeys, and they promised orcs from the Lord of the Rings. And then they explained to the audience, who was surprised to come to the circus and be confronted with an orcless piece of entertainment, that the orcs were, quote, held up in customs. Of course they were.
Who'd
let
you can't
be bringing orcs into the country. But better still, if you actually didn't mind that the orcs were held up in customs and went, apparently, some of the artists in the circus were falling off their bicycles, and jugglers were dropping the Indian clubs, and they were accused of being drunk. Also, keep in mind, if you're taking a tour, those orcs that were not stuck at customs, they were said by the organizers to be somewhere outside Moscow. And at least two of them have contracts with National Hockey League teams.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America. This is a story that belongs in Idiot America. I think it didn't occur in America, but what the heck? Anyway, various other books as well, and Charlie joins me each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Over the years, we've presented several stories about concussions and traumatic brain injuries suffered by athletes, especially pro football players. In response to my recent commentary touching on that subject, Peter Simshauser, a WBUR listener, wrote to point out that, quote, a major portion of the January 8th Only a Game was devoted to discussion of the NFL. He went on to say, I suspect that listeners awaiting an announcement that the show will eliminate or reduce its focus on the NFL in the light of injury risks, we'll wait in vain. He's right. We won't ignore the industry of pro football because the game damages some of its players. We also won't ignore the consequences. Listeners often write to suggest sports that we have failed to feature. This week, Andy DePalma, who hears the program on WAMC in Albany, New York, brought to our attention a sport called bonving. As far as I can tell, he wrote, the game involves tossing sneakers and catching them in plastic waste baskets. So we'll certainly look forward to bonving. Henry Stark of Ithaca, New York, was unhappy with some of what we hoped might pass for humor on last week's program. Listening to your broadcast, I got really angry at your comments trashing the Seattle Seahawks, he wrote. Your guest's list of the 10 worst playoff teams spoke to me in a negative way. I hope last night's result, meaning last Saturday's game in which the Seahawks upset the Saints 41-36, will help add some humility to your frequent ridicule of sports participants. Manuel Hernandez, a WBUR listener, wrote to accuse Charlie Pierce of telling, quote, bad, irreverent, and shocking jokes about Boston institutions, including Ted Williams. But Mr. Hernandez went on to conclude that he listens to the program because he finds Charlie's, quote, horrible, disruptive, and smart-ass commentary brilliant and funny. So there you have it. A more straightforward email came from a listener named Constance who wrote, gotta tell you, I'm an 80-year-old who really is not interested in sports, having been married for nearly 60 years to a guy who is a rabid sports fan, but I so look forward to your broadcasts each Saturday morning. Your sense of humor, your commentaries, and your guests always start my day with a smile. Keep it up. You can register your opinions at our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line, 617-353-1860. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Thank you. Polo has always been a sport of nobility, but in some urban hubs around the world, polo is more about improvised playing areas and nimble bicycles than it is about lush turf and expensive ponies. Producer Ashley Ahern recently attended a bike polo match that took place in a downtown Los Angeles warehouse, and she brings us this audio portrait.
My name is Alex Dash, and I'm here to play some bike polo.
Pretty cool place. We got, like, part of the court is a wall right here. And the boards that we're using right now are church pews. They're pretty big, pretty heavy. They make good boards. And, it looks like they're about to start up.
Set it up! Let's go! 3, 2, 1, follow!
People just take off. They charge to the ball at half court. It's placed on the ground. It's supposed to be one person per team that goes and gets it, or gets there first, you know, they fight for it, and then that's how you kick it off.
My name is Robert. I play bike polo, yeah. It's polo, like on a horse, but on a bike. It's a gentleman's game, but rough around the edges.
You're about to get an ass whooping unlike no other. Great.
If you put your foot down, you have to go in the middle and tap your mallet and come back and enter the game. You can use all types of things. You can use a croquet mallet, but a standard legal pole would be a ski pole. And there's a certain thing on the side of the mallet you call a shuffle where you're actually just carrying the ball with you, but you can't score that way. You have to score on the tip of the mallet. There's a little bit of a physical contact, a little bit of mallet contact. You can hit each other's mallet. It's a pretty simple game.
The hottest stuff right now is people, like, they scoop the ball up with the mallet and they can do these, like, skyhook-like passes. My style is, like, very meat and potatoes. Shoot, pass, handle, control, rather than all this fancy flary stuff. Is flary a word? For as long as I can remember, I've always been riding bikes places, and then when I found polo, just clicked. I was hooked the first day, totally addicted. Like, I went home thinking about polo and what I was going to do to make the bike better for it, and, you know, I wanted to do a mallet and I wanted to do this and that, and all week long I was thinking about it, and it's still the same thing. Like, I have polo dreams almost every night, and I still, like, every, it's like, when is it going to be Wednesday, and when is it going to be Friday? Oh, we're going to play in the warehouse, that's on Thursday, okay, and then Friday, and then maybe Saturday, probably not, and then Sunday all day, and then, like, I'm waiting again to Wednesday, and, you know, when's the next tournament going to happen, and then we're going to, when are we going to the next thing? Oh, we're going to Arizona. Okay, all right. We got to get ready for the kids in Arizona. You know, always something like that. And then, you know, we have a website online. We have a forum that a lot of people use. And, you know, what are they talking about there? They're talking about some new rule or some new cheater mallet from Europe or all these other things that are going on. And you've got to stay up on it. And before you know it, the tournament's there. So then you've got to go to the tournament. And then, you know, you got to win that tournament. And then you got to go online and tell everybody. And then when's the next tournament?
4-2, 4-3, 4-3. I think it's bigger ever than it's ever been here.
Yeah, it's getting huge. They just had the World Championships in Berlin just a few months ago. And the World Championships this year is going to be in Seattle. So it's all over the place, worldwide. Australia, even China was in the newspaper playing their stuff. Japan's real big. A lot of people.
Something that's definitely on our minds tonight is the tournament in Arizona. That's coming up at the end of January, and that's one that we really have to compete well in. We've won the first two tournaments there. My teammate David and I, we know who our competition is out there. They literally are kids. One of them's like, he's like 21 years old, and he looks like a little kid. And then his brothers and cousins, I forget the exact relationship, but they're in middle school, and if you've ever been on the polo scene and you've seen these kids, they will light you up. They will make grown men look foolish. It's not a joke. They're probably better than like 70% or 80% of the teams out there. We face them in the finals every year, and I know they want it. They want it just as bad as we do, and I think it's going to be a real fierce final, but they're definitely some of the most talented, smartest players I've ever played against. They're also the smallest. you have to have like an understanding girlfriend, I gotta say, because it's a lot, you know, like I'm here quite a bit, but I love it. I mean, you know, I really love it. It's like, it's my game.
Amanda, Robert, and Alex will be among the Los Angelino bike polo players competing in the Desert Polo Invite in Tempe, Arizona on January 29th and 30th. To see pictures from the LA bike polo match, visit our website. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Mark Filippino. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from New England Patriots receiver Darnell Jenkins, who gives us some advice about how to play his position.
I got to stay relaxed. Don't move.
Oh, wait, that's advice about how to behave when you're getting a haircut. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and healthcare at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.